Security Council approves a resolution demanding faster delivery of humanitarian aid into Gaza, but stops short of calling for a ceasefire. Palestinians say the UN Security Council resolution on Gaza is insufficient, calling for an immediate end to Israel's war of genocide on a besieged territory. And the Iraqi resistance fighters say they have targeted an Israeli gas rig in the Mediterranean Sea in support of the Palestinian people. Thank you for joining us. Now, the UN Security Council has passed a resolution to facilitate aid deliveries to Gaza, reeling from a deadly and devastating Israeli onslaught. The resolution, however, fails to call for a ceasefire. The original draft by the UAE was repeatedly watered down by the US to remove a clause for a cessation or even a suspension of Israeli attacks. This provoked the outrage of Russia, which also pointed to what it called a dangerous provision in the final draft allowing Israel to continue its genocide in Gaza.
In the last few days, the Security Council and together with it the entire world has been witness to the latest, and I'm not afraid to use this word, shameful, cynical and irresponsible conduct by the United States. The world media and public this entire time have been wondering, why is the vote constantly being delayed on the UAE proposed draft, which was already put in blue? The answer is very simple. The United States, under various pretexts, has been dragging out the negotiating process, deviating from the normal, transparent negotiating work. Instead of this, they have resorted to their favored tactic of gross pressure, blackmail, and twisting arms so that at the last minute, they'd be able to present the members of the Council with an ultimatum. Either the Council adopts a text that is convenient for Washington, or the United States will once again block the adoption of any product. Through the efforts of the American delegation, the draft resolution has included an extremely dangerous element for the future of Gaza. Instead of the wording on an immediate cessation of violence in OP2, an ambiguous phrase has appeared calling for the parties to create conditions for a cessation of hostilities. Colleagues, destruction or displacement or the exile of the population of Gaza in a cynical reading, and that is precisely how it is going to be read in Israel, would also create the conditions for a cessation of hostilities. By signing off on this, the Council would essentially be giving the Israeli armed forces complete freedom of movement for further clearing of the Gaza Strip, and anyone who votes in favor of the text as it is currently worded would bear responsibility for that, essentially becoming complicit in the destruction of Gaza.
The Russian representative also criticized the failure of the resolution to condemn the indiscriminate attacks on civilians. He said this gives Israel a green light to further its war crimes in Gaza. Nebenzia also proposed an amendment to the UN resolution, but this was vetoed by the US. The US has almost always used this veto power at the UN Security Council to nix resolutions critical of Israel. The Hamas resistance movement has called the UN Security Council resolution on Gaza insufficient, including the failure to call for a ceasefire. Hamas said the move does not address the current catastrophic situation in Gaza, created by what the movement called the Israeli terror apparatus. Hamas stressed that the resolution specifically fails to call for an end to the war of genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The movement added that the US watered down the resolution to pave the way for what it called the massacre and terror in the territory. Hamas called on the Security Council to require Israel to deliver aid to the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the Palestinian ambassador to the UN says the overwhelming majority of member states have been mobilizing for an immediate ceasefire.
No one should forget that what we are talking about are 2.3 million Palestinians who have been fighting for their life and facing death every single day for 75 days. They have been fighting for their lives, for their very existence, for over 75 days. Mr. President, the Arab and the OIC groups, with the support of an overwhelming number of UN member states, have been mobilizing for three objectives. And we said that from the beginning. End the carnage immediately. Immediate ceasefire. Humanitarian assistance at scale and no forced displacement. We meet today as part of this continuous effort to advance these three goals.
Masoud Chajere is the chairman of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission. He says the U.S. is buying time for Israel to commit more genocide in Gaza.
In short, too little, too late. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the whole of the international community are screaming that something needs to be done. There has to be ceasefire. There has to be an end to this genocide, which has already killed more than 20,000 innocent people. Overwhelming majority of them are women and children. And we know very clearly that this is not it. As a matter of fact, there are many bodies who are under the rubble and they haven't been found yet. And people are starving. There is such a chaos, such a murderous plot being unleashed. And all the time, United States has been buying time so more innocent people to be killed, more women, more children, more destruction, more hospitals, more schools, more churches, mosques, etc., to be destroyed. This is outrageous. This is really outrageous. Even at this 11th hour, they come up with this plot to actually change the wording to sort of give the Zionist state, this illegal, brutal occupier, this system which is systematically committing genocide, more time to kill more and with the punity.
Day 77 of Israel's genocide in Gaza, where Palestinians are facing an unending nightmare of bloodshed, with the death toll increasing by the hour. The latest attacks have targeted the cities of Rafah, Khan Yunis and Jabalia, killing dozens of Palestinians. Over the past 2 days, the Israeli bombardment took the lives of around 400 people and injured hundreds more. The total number of Palestinians killed since October the 7th has passed 20,000, mostly women and children. Experts on wartime mapping say the relentless airstrikes and shelling have destroyed two-thirds of all structures in northern Gaza and a quarter in the south. All across the Palestinian territory, hospitals are still a prime target of the Israeli bombing campaign. According to official figures, around 90% of the population in Gaza have been displaced as a result of the Israeli war. For those displaced, things are difficult as Gaza faces a severe shortage of basic supplies.
There is no safe place in Gaza, but living in Rafah is really difficult. They heat a lot of water tanks. Life is really expensive. There is no safe place.
We saw some people, half of whom went to Rafah and the other half to Khan Yunis. We wanted to choose the nearest destination. There is no water. Everything is expensive. We can't buy anything for our children.
There's no safe places. everything has been bombed and people are really scared. They tell you go east and then tell you go west. The situation is very difficult. People are gathered in this area because they were told that Khan Yunus was safe, and now they are being asked to go to Rafah, except that Rafah has been totally bombed. People are scared after bombing of Nas Hospital. People are really terrified. Everyone is afraid of what's going to happen. The bombings are scaring children and the elderly.
In yet another heinous crime, the Israeli army has arrested a number of Red Crescent workers who were on duty in a hospital in the Jabalia refugee camp. The incident took place on Friday morning. This is not the first time the Israeli army arrested medical personnel. Already, over 100 medical staff have been arrested while working in hospitals in northern Gaza. The Hamas resistance movement says the move constitutes a war crime and proves the fascism of the enemy, which is systematically destroying the health sector. Hamas called on international organizations to shoulder their responsibilities to protect medical facilities and personnel and to put pressure on the Israeli regime to immediately release all Palestinians kidnapped from shelters and hospitals. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it attacked what it called a vital target in the Mediterranean Sea a few days ago in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. A source in the resistance group says the target was the Karish natural gas rig operated by Israel. This comes after the resistance group carried out a number of attacks against Israeli cities. Earlier on Friday, the group targeted Eilat port city in response to the regime's massacre of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has also targeted major American military bases in Syria and Iraq over the past months in response to the U.S. support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Hezbollah resistance group says it has hit six Israeli military targets across southern Lebanese borders. Hezbollah says it struck and damaged the targets with appropriate weapons. The group also says it has launched missiles and artillery shells at gatherings of Israeli forces. According to the movement, the operations are in response to the regime's crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military has so far confirmed one death and one injury due to the latest rocket fire from Lebanon. The regime has also launched attacks on Hezbollah's positions. The area along Lebanon's southern border has frequently witnessed exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and Israel since the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip on October the 7th. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have voiced solidarity with their fellow compatriots in Gaza facing Israeli genocide. Carrying the flags of the Hamas resistance movement, demonstrators rallied in the city of Ramallah and stressed the Palestinians' right to resist the Israeli occupation. In the Jordanian capital, Amman, people also took part in a similar solidarity protest near the U.S. embassy. They slammed the U.S. as an accomplice in Israel's massacres in Gaza. The protesters urged their country to cut diplomatic ties with Israel and end Western military presence in the kingdom. Yemen also saw thousands of people flocking to the streets to express their support for Gazans. The rallies took place in the capital Sana'a and the northern city of Sa'ada. The protesters chanted slogans against the Israeli regime. They also slammed the U.S. over its unconditional support for the occupying regime and Washington's newly formed naval coalition in the Red Sea. The protesters reiterated their support for Yemen's retaliatory military measures targeting Israel. Those include missile and drone attacks against targets in the occupied Palestine and operations against Israeli-linked ships. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Yusuf Mawri, tells us more about the defiant message the Yemenis are sending to the U.S. and its allies.
The theme of today's protest is dubbed, "We are not scared of the American coalition, and we will always stand with Gaza. This was the actual title of today's demonstration, and this is basically to send a message to this newly formed American-led coalition that Yemenis are not intimidated and that the U.S. will not be able to strike fear into the hearts of the Yemeni people, because the hearts of the Yemeni people is with the people of Gaza, and it will remain so until the genocide ends. And they will continue, as you mentioned, to target Israeli ships and Israeli shipments, not just in the Red Sea, also in the Gulf of Aden, and also in the Arabian Sea. As as we have seen over the past couple of weeks, major shipping companies, major oil companies, have suspended their shipments through the Red Sea because of this military initiative by Yemen's naval forces. Of course, it is causing a huge, huge problem for the Israeli economy. As you know, we've heard reports, we've heard Israeli financial advisors basically stating that because of these operations in the Red Sea against the Israeli government, Israel has lost $80 billion in just a month of military operations targeting Israeli shipments. And that's a lot of money for the Israeli economy.
Iran has rejected, quote, any claim for any side from any side on its sovereignty over the three Persian Gulf islands of Abu Musa, as well as the greater and lesser tombs. The Iranian foreign minister said Tehran would not compromise on its territorial integrity. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a phone call with his Russian counterpart. The comments came in response to the final statement at the sixth meeting of the Arab-Russian Cooperation Forum in Morocco. For his part, Sergei Lavrov said Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity has always been respected by Russia and should never be doubted. He said Moscow underscored this issue in the lead-up to the final statement of the Morocco meeting. And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Three Palestinian human rights organizations have issued a stern warning regarding the Israeli regime's forced displacement of Palestinians in Gaza, saying it could lead to another Nakba or catastrophe in the Gaza Strip. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Electronic Intifada has covered this story and tells us more. In a house in Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, Husson, her four sons and their families have sought shelter with Husson's sister and her family. Husson, which means beauty in Arabic, is 84 years old. Her journey to Rafah from the beach camp in Gaza City, which she had to leave because of Israel's bombardment, was long and perilous. On the way, she and her sons took shelter in a school until that too was no longer safe. And through it all, she remembered the original Nakba, the homelessness, fear and massacres of 1948, when she and her family were displaced from their home in the Ramla area of Palestine. Even then, she told the Electronic Intifada, "This is as bad, if not worse. I regret moving here. If I had the chance again, I would stay in the beach camp rather than experience what is more catastrophic than the 48 Nakba." Husan was born in 1939 to a middle-income family in the village of Zarnuga in the Ramla area of Palestine. She was the first of 11 children, 7 girls and 4 boys. Her father was a farmer who worked for a large merchant, while her mother sold produce from a store. The family would store grains and barley underground. But while relatively wealthy, Husan never received an education. She was born during the Palestinian revolt against Britain's then colonial administration in Palestine and the Zionist colonization project which it sponsored. The revolt lasted from 1936 to 1939. Times were difficult and the cost of living was high. She remembers the years of the Nakba as years of displacement, fear, bombings and massacres. She and her family were displaced all the way to Gaza. After marrying young, Husan settled in the beach refugee camp in Gaza City. Her family grew eventually, comprising 9 boys and 4 girls. There were losses along the way. Her firstborn, Juma, died just 21 days old. Then, 35 years ago, her husband Khalil, who worked with a local charity, fell on the street. At Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, he was diagnosed with high blood pressure. It kept getting worse until he lost the use of an arm and a leg. He died shortly after. His older sons decided to step up. Mahmoud and Ibrahim found work in Israel, reasoning that they needed to make enough money to provide for the family. Husan always had a soft spot for Ibrahim, who would always buy her presents and was generous to others, giving away too much to those in need. But both sons passed away before her. Ibrahim had a sudden stroke. Mahmoud died of high blood pressure. In all, and over the years, from her 13 children, 7 have passed away. The Zionist regime's violence has been ever present in Husan's long life. During Israel's aggression on Gaza in 2014, the Israeli military bombed the home of her youngest son, Salah. Salah's baby daughter, Tora, was killed. His other daughter, Hala, broke her arm and his wife had to receive treatment for 6 months because of her injuries. Salah himself, who was not at home at the time of the bombing, was so affected that he collapsed upon hearing the news. Gradually, he lost the ability to walk. Doctors could not find any medical explanation for his disability. He now uses a wheelchair. Allah helps to feed him, wash him, and take him to the bathroom. At the beginning of the Zionist regime's latest genocidal attack on Gaza, Husan and her family had resolved that, come what may, they would stay in their modest home in the beach camp in Gaza City. "In all the previous aggressions, I had never left my home," Husan told the Electronic Intifada. "I would never repeat what happened in 1948. But the fighting came closer, and the Zionist regime's indiscriminate bombing grew ever more deadly. As civilian infrastructure, homes, hospitals, mosques and schools around them was reduced to rubble, and it became clear that no international power would intervene, the situation felt ever more dangerous. One afternoon, while Husan was resting next to Salah, the house suddenly shook with the impact of a nearby explosion, piercing the corrugated iron roof. Their neighbor's house had been bombed, and many houses around them were completely or partially destroyed. Israeli warplanes then targeted the ambulance and civil defense crews that tried to rescue civilians. It was left to the young men of the area to search through the rubble for casualties. No one, as it turned out, was critically injured in that bombing. but Husson started to be increasingly worried for the safety of her family, especially Salah, who uses a wheelchair. Reluctantly, they decided to move to a nearby Abu Asi school in search of safety. During the first period at the school, people used to go to their homes every morning to shower and cook. In the beginning, food was available. In time, it started to become scarce and expensive. They lived on fried tomatoes, potatoes, and eggplant. Water supplies ran low, affecting everything from cooking to hygiene, a situation that got worse as the number of displaced people rose. The war intensified in the north of Gaza. Bombings became increasingly random and increasingly targeting the center of Gaza. Everything seems to be a target. They were miserable days, Husson says. Imagine 65 people, men, women and children, infants, disabled and the elderly, all in one classroom using a single bathroom. The bombings became incessant. Missiles landed all around the school, targeting the surrounding houses. One day, the nearby Ahmad Yassin Mosque was entirely destroyed. Everyone around me ran out of the class. People were screaming. My heart was racing and the thoughts of the Nakba were haunting me, Husson says. The school emptied in panic, leaving just Husson, Salah and Hala, who tried and failed to carry her father and grandmother out. When the bombing eased, some men arrived to carry her and her son outside the school until her other sons arrived. They headed south. Her son, Khader, stayed north, refusing to be displaced, refusing to help Israel's attempt at the wholesale ethnic cleansing of Gaza. He made sure that his wife and six children found shelter at the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, but decided to stay in a school near his own home, which had already been destroyed in the bombing. Just days after she arrived in the south, Husson learned that Khader had been killed in an Israeli airstrike. His body had only been discovered in the school after a number of days. He was buried at the school during the brief truce in November, without any family present. For now, Husson and her four sons are staying with Husson's sister in Rafah, in the very south of Gaza. Husson regrets moving. She is not afraid of death. It is this life she fears, she tells the Electronic Intifada, a life that has involved constant displacement and catastrophic loss. She is struggling. She says, one heart cannot bear two Nakbas.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, how about listening to the thought-provoking words of the Holy Prophet's sixth infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, regarding the lofty epithets in the divine court of his most noble ancestress, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Fatima has nine names near Allah the Exalted. These are Sadiqah, or the Most Truthful, Mubarakah, or the Blessed, Tahira, or the Spotlessly Pure, Zakiyah, or the Pristinely Chaste, Raziyah al-Marziyah, or the One who is gratified and contented with God's will, Muhaddasah, or the Lady to whom angels speak, and Zahra, or the Most Radiant.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Fighting Injustice and Oppression. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, has said, "You must be enemies of the oppressors and defenders or the supporters of the oppressed." This is the command of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first divinely appointed Imam, the successor of the Holy Prophet. It is not simply a recommendation or advice. You know, sometimes people think that, oh, it's just, you know, something that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, you know, just as advice, admonishment. No, this is, you know, it is a command that he is giving to the believers, right? Being an enemy of the oppressor and the defender of the oppressed is an Islamic duty. It is not something that can be ignored by the believers, you know, at any cost. Fighting the unjust and supporting those who are subjected to injustice, it is a responsibility. In today's time, for example, fighting the Zionists and supporting the oppressed Palestinians is a responsibility of every Muslim. It is not an optional thing that, oh, okay, if you have time, you know, go ahead and support them. Or you don't have anything better to do, then you just, you know, support them on social media, for instance. No, brothers and sisters, supporting these oppressed Palestinians against the evil and oppressive Zionists, it is a responsibility that Islam puts on our shoulders. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "He who is unjust, his injustice will destroy him." If you notice, it is the fault of the unjust that they get fought against by the justice seekers. When someone tramples over the rights of on any innocent people, they will have to face the reaction that will destroy them. And today we are seeing that the Palestinians are resisting against the Israeli occupation. And, you know, the reaction to that is because of Israel and its wrongdoings itself for 75 years. So today we are seeing a reaction by the Palestinians. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing fighting injustice and oppression according to the teachings of Quran and Ahlul Bayt. An unjust person, brothers and sisters, is the cause of his own destruction. There is a divine principle behind the scenes. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "He who is unjust destroys himself." Doing injustice towards the creation of Allah is very disliked by Allah. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "He who wrongs Allah's servants, Allah will be his enemy besides his servants. And he whose enemy is Allah will be condemned and punished in this world and the world to come." Just imagine, brothers and sisters, when Allah the Almighty becomes someone's enemy. Imam Ali alayhi salam also said, "Keep far from injustice, for it is the greatest guilt and the gravest sin." Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed Imam, he said, "The injustice of this world brings the darkness of the world to come." And similarly, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, has said, "He who wrongs people cannot be counted as a Shia," that is, the followers of Ahlul Bayt. So, brothers and sisters, we see that fighting injustice and fighting oppression, and at the same time, siding with the oppressed, supporting the oppressed, aiding the oppressed, strengthening the oppressed, these are the ethos of Islam. These are the basic building blocks of Islamic value system, right? So, given the instructions of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt and the Holy Quran, it is very obvious what we are supposed to do.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Since the beginning of Israel's onslaught on Gaza, Western countries and the U.S. in particular have voiced their unequivocal support for Israel and what they call Tel Aviv's right of self-defense, while ignoring the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. The U.S. President Joe Biden visited Israel shortly after the Israeli military started the massive war on Gaza. Biden unequivocally justified the Israeli regime's genocide in the coastal Gaza Strip, saying Washington would provide the Israeli regime with everything it needed to, quote, defend itself.
Israel has the right, and I would add a responsibility, to respond to the slaughter of their people. And we will ensure Israel has what it needs to defend itself against these terrorists. That's a guarantee.
Analysts believe when it comes to Israel, Biden echoes the policies crafted not in Washington, but in Tel Aviv.
You listen to President Biden, and it sounds like he's reading from an Israeli teleprompter. Line after line after line are lines that you hear from Netanyahu, or you hear from his ministers, or you hear from Israeli propagandists. Line after line after line in the things that the president says from the beginning of this war until today. Crafted in Tel Aviv. Crafted in Jerusalem.
The U.S. president has also promised to ask Congress for an unprecedented military aid package for Israel to assist its ongoing war on Gaza.
For decades, we've ensured Israel's qualitative military edge. And later this week, I'm going to ask the United States Congress for an unprecedented support package for Israel's defense.
The Biden administration has asked for an additional $14 billion for Israel from Congress. This request is focused on providing air and missile defense support and replenishing U.S. military stockpiles given to Israel. Currently, Israel receives $3.8 billion in military aid from the U.S. annually under a memorandum signed in 2019. That accounted for about 16% of Israel's total military budget in 2022. The United States has always made it clear that nothing can stop it from supporting its staunch ally.
We will support them in any way that we can, and certainly intelligence is a part of that, and I won't get into the specifics of what that means, ISR, other types of collection. We've worked with the Israelis you know, over many, many years. And those sharing mechanisms are there. Those channels are there to share information. And we will look to continue to do that.
The U.S. has strong historical and economic ties to Israel. The U.S., which has supported the formation of Israel since World War II, is Israel's top trading partner, with annual bilateral trade of nearly $50 billion in goods and services. As a matter of fact, experts believe the creation of Israel was the direct result of imperial powers' support, including Britain and United States policies.
Without the external support that Zionism received from the British, none of what we have seen in the past century and more would have happened as it did. British and later American and other external support were absolutely essential to the success of the Zionist project from the very beginning.
Shortly after the beginning of the Nakba, or the catastrophe, in which Zionist forces expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and established Israel, the United States started transferring a huge cache of weapons to Israel. According to data recently published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, the United States provided Israel with more than 70,000 weapons between 1950 and 2022. The weapons included aircraft, ground vehicles, missiles, and bombs, most of which were used against the defenseless people of Palestine. Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign military financing, with most of that aid coming in the form of weapons grants. The U.S. has provided Israel with at least 16 types of weapons in 2023, including missiles and aircraft. It is widely believed that U.S. support has emboldened Israel in its atrocities against the Palestinian people. Just recently, even a U.S. State Department official also resigned over the transfer of arms to Israel, amid growing dissent over President Biden's unequivocal support for the regime.
I think we have to look at the situation on the ground and say, is that what is actually happening? Is Israel more secure as a result of our assistance, or has our military assistance enabled Israel to move ahead with the expansion of settlements in the West Bank, to continue the siege of Gaza, and to take steps that ultimately undermine its own security?
In fact, the U.S.-made weapons are being used extensively in the current Israeli operations in Gaza. Apart from ground-penetrating munitions, the U.S. has also given Israel several other types of bombs and artillery shells. The United States has given so-called bunker buster bombs and an array of other munitions to Israel for its war on Gaza. A Wall Street Journal report citing unnamed U.S. officials said Washington has transferred 100 BLU-109 bombs to Israel that are meant to penetrate hardened structures before exploding. The U.S. has also sent special forces to the occupied territories to assist the Israeli military, according to American officials. The commandos are in Gaza to help the Israeli military in finding captives held by Palestinian fighters. While there is overwhelming bipartisan support for Israel among the American politicians, some critics are now casting doubt on whether spending taxpayer dollars to provide such huge funds serves the interests of the American people.
Yes, there are enormous emergencies abroad, but there are also very serious emergencies in our own country, including the crises we face in childcare, in primary health care, housing, and in other needs. The American people do not want us to continue to ignore these issues. I do not believe we should be appropriating over $10 billion for the right-wing extremist Netanyahu government to continue its current military approach. What the Netanyahu government is doing is immoral. It is in violation of international law, and the United States should not be complicit in those actions.
But the question to ask is why the American officials, including Democrats and Republicans, are so committed to supporting Israel, ignoring the needs of their own people.
The simple answer is it's because they're under the thumb of the Israel lobby. Israel has penetrated our government system very effectively through the lobby. This is what you get out of the other end. As far as these people are concerned, you have there is a First Amendment and you have freedom of speech in the United States, unless you're saying something about Israel. And this is appalling. This is disgusting. But the fact is they get away with it because they have such influence around, I would even go further, control over many congressmen. They are major donors to congressmen, and this has an impact. They have major influence over what appears in the media, and this has a major impact on politicians running for office.
However, it seems that the younger American generation no longer buys the propaganda spread by mainstream media, desperately trying to justify U.S. support for Israel. Surveys show a growing number of American youths has an unfavorable view of Israel over its recent genocide in Gaza.
Black intellectuals, Native American intellectuals, Hispanic intellectuals are all much more critical of Israel, especially the younger ones, than are their elders or than are Republicans as a general rule. And this is not just true of young black students or young Latino students or young Arab or Muslim students. It's also true of many young Jewish students. You look at college campuses, and Jewish Voice for Peace is a central component of the drives for divestment of these universities' assets from companies that support the Israeli occupation and of Palestinian rights generally. So this is there's a generational divide.
If once the unconditional support of the Israeli regime was something for U.S. politicians to take pride in, it seems that it's going to cost them politically in the near future, as more and more people in the United States are getting to know more about the realities of the occupied territories.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Israeli regime's drone strikes in Al-Sabat neighborhood in the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank has killed four Palestinians, two of them children. They were named as 17-year-old Thayer Shadi Tabaji and 16-year-old Rafiq Mohammad Isqaili. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website Electronic Intifada has covered this story and tells us more. During the Zionist regime's offensive on the northern occupied West Bank city of Jenin and its refugee camp that lasted more than 60 hours, at least 12 Palestinians, including four children, were killed. This was one of the longest single military raids in Jenin and its refugee camp since the Second Intifada, the Israeli regime media have reported. The Zionist regime's campaign of killing and destruction of the refugee camp's infrastructure also involved Israeli military firing drone missiles and Energa anti-tank rifle grenades into at least 10 homes in Jenin and its refugee camp, destroying them completely, according to the Palestinian Wafa news agency. Army bulldozers cause extensive damage to Jenin and its refugee camp's infrastructure, including streets, water supplies, electricity and sewage networks. The Israeli military also bombed commercial shops and a barber shop, burnt and destroyed fruit and vegetable stands as well as Palestinian vehicles in the area, and seized a number of them, according to the Palestinian Wafaa news agency. The Israeli military imposed a curfew on residents, raided people's homes and used them as military bases, stationed snipers on the rooftops of buildings, and conducted mass arrests. Hundreds of Palestinians were arrested, including some who were released outside of the city after having been interrogated. They were not allowed to return to Jenin and were forced to take shelter in nearby communities, according to the United Nations Monitoring Group, OCHA, report. Dozens of Palestinians were injured in the Israeli attack on Jenin, including at least 10 with live ammunition, according to the Palestinian Wafaa news agency. The Zionist regime's raid in Jenin and its refugee camp was even larger in scale, destruction and lethality than a military offensive it carried out there in July, which was dubbed the biggest military operation since the Second Intifada. The Israeli military fired drone missiles against groups of people. Three of those killed in the drone attacks were children. A drone strike in Al-Sabat neighborhood in the city of Jenin recently killed four Palestinians, two of them children. They were named as 17-year-old Tha'er Shadi Tabaji and 16-year-old Rafiq Mohammad Ezgeli. An Israeli drone missile killed a 13-year-old teenage boy recently. Bashar Haytham Abu Zaid had been standing with several other Palestinian youth who were throwing bottles filled with motor oil towards Israeli military vehicles. An Israeli drone missile hit the group, killing Bashar and two others. Israeli military are now routinely using weaponized aerial drones to carry out attacks against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, according to Ayed Abu Akhtesh, accountability program director at DCIP. After years of Israeli forces increasingly unlawfully killing Palestinian children with impunity, we now see Israeli forces escalate tactics to carry out aerial attacks against children in a hyper-militarized environment where Palestinian children bear the brunt of Israeli military aggression. A fourth Palestinian child was killed by live fire during the incursion. An Israeli soldier stationed inside a heavily armored vehicle shot at Palestinians standing within 100 meters of an all-girls school throwing stones. Musa Ahmad Khatib, a 15-year-old teenager, was shot by the Israeli soldier with a bullet to his chest that exited his back. Musa Ahmad Khatib ran into the hospital's emergency department where he collapsed to the floor. According to eyewitness accounts by Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders and the Ministry of Health in the West Bank, he was shot by Israeli military while he was standing within the Khalil Suleiman Hospital compound. The Zionist regime forces fired on an ambulance and blocked others. Israeli forces also besieged a number of hospitals in the area. Two Palestinians, including a 13-year-old teenage boy, died due to their inability to arrive at hospital in time to be treated. The Palestinian Authority Health Minister said hospitals in the area were subjected to a fierce attack by the Israeli military. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said that it had not been able to respond to any calls from inside the city of Jenin and its refugee camp since the previous day. Hundreds of kidney dialysis patients were stranded in Jenin, unable to reach hospital due to the Israeli army designating certain areas as closed military zones, according to the Palestinian Wafaa news agency report. In addition to attacks on medical facilities and personnel, Israeli soldiers also desecrated a mosque in Jenin and vandalized the exterior walls of the mosque. Video footage circulated online depicted Israeli soldiers singing Hanukkah and other songs through the mosque loudspeakers, audible across the area in mosque's vicinity. The Israeli army suggested it would discipline the soldiers involved. Since 7th of October, the Israeli regime's fire has killed at least 78 Palestinians in the city of Jenin and its refugee camp. Israeli regime troops have killed at least 266 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since 7th of October, and an additional 8 were killed by Israeli settlers, according to the United Nations Monitoring Group, the OCHA. This constitutes more than half of all Israeli killings in the area since the beginning of the year, as 2023 concludes this year stands as the deadliest for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the United Nations Monitoring Office began recording such data in 2005. The Israeli military have injured over 3,500 Palestinians in the West Bank since 7th of October, more than 540 of them children.
Midstream.
Zionist Israeli entity intensified its aggression on Gaza while keeping one eye on Hezbollah in Lebanon and the other on the West Bank, primarily due to its strategic proximity. Neither the entity nor the United States of America foresaw that Yemen, which has been at war for years without a practical resolution, would turn into a new front. In November, the Yemeni armed forces declared war on the Zionist entity in support of the resistance in Gaza, presenting a significant and unwelcome surprise for the entity. Yemen initiated missile and drone attacks on targets in the Zionist Israeli port of Eilat, overlooking the Red Sea. However, the Yemeni armed forces did not stop there and announced the imposition of what could be described as a naval blockade on the entity. It appears that there are significant losses due to the Yemeni missiles, prompting the Pentagon in the first week of December to announce a plan to form a naval force to so-called protect international navigation in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and the Red Sea. However, despite the availability of European countries' warships and frigates, they do not express great enthusiasm to join this force. Well, that is mainly due to the fact that European countries do not possess a large naval fleet. Warships are distributed between protecting the coasts of these countries and positioning near Ukraine in anticipation of any developments in the Russian-Ukrainian war. On the other hand, these countries are concerned that if they participate in confronting the Yemeni armed forces in their Gaza support operations, their commercial ships passing through the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea could themselves become targets for the Yemenis. In the meantime, despite the Pentagon's threat to respond to the Yemenis, the Yemeni armed forces daily reaffirm their determination to continue targeting Israeli entity ships and ships bound towards occupied Palestine until the Zionist entity ends the genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The matter is no longer limited to imposing a blockade on Zionist Israeli ports. The geostrategic battle and its escalating events are shaking the world. The closure of the Red Sea to ships colluding with the enemy turns into a heroic festival, teaching the U.S. and Zionist Israel harsh lessons and threatening them with more successive blows capable of breaking their alliances and coercive global policies. These strikes establish a new stage of resistance given the expansion of its military operations and the development of its capabilities to combat malicious international hegemony. There is a clear